This is
Make It Kind.
M.I.P.
with Masamela Matfumo.
Mark Thompson.
Make It Kind.
Get woke.
New from Radiotopia presents Red for Revolution, an audio drama about Black love, queer romance, and liberation. Join Jasmine, an 18-year-old navigating her queer identity while learning about her grandmother's secret love affair. Through her discoveries, we're transported back to 1971 to witness two remarkable women embark on a romance that defies all conventions. Subscribe to Radiotopia Presents and listen to Red for Revolution wherever you get your podcasts.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
Welcome to another edition of Make It Plain on WPFW-FM Pacifica Radio. How many of you have seen Ken Burns' American Revolution? If you haven't, again, that's public on PBS, just like we're Pacifica, we're public. I encourage you to see it. A lot of great history there. And one of the main characters in it, not a main actor, really not a character. He's a historian, but, you know, he's in a documentary now. So, you know, he gets a IMDb thing and all of that. So he's in a major feature. And we're happy to have him because he makes such a great contribution. And I wanted to talk to him about it. He is none other than Dr. Christopher Brown of Columbia University, previously at Rutgers and Johns Hopkins. His research centers on the history of the European experience on the African coast at the height of the Atlantic slave trade, as well as the rise and fall of slavery in the British Empire. So he knows of which he speaks on American Revolution. His courses have been slavery and world history, the Atlantic slave trade, the British Empire, and many, many others. And so we're honored to have Dr. Christopher Brown with us on Make It Plain this morning. Dr. Brown, welcome. How are you?
I'm great, Reverend Marcus. It's so wonderful to be here and have this conversation with you.
The American Revolution, Ken Burns has become prolific with these documentaries. Yeah. We first met when he did jazz and baseball and the Civil War. Matter of fact, I like to say this to people. Years ago, when he did Jack Johnson, and we know the interest Ken Burns has had in Black history.
Yes.
He was on my show, man, and I said, Ken, what is your interest in Black history? And you know what he said to me? I'll never forget it. He said, Mark, if history is a universe, Black history is the shining sun. Yeah. And I never heard a Black person say that. So I was, you know what I'm saying? So it's real. And he did Jackie Robinson. So I want to say something, and let's start here. And I'd love to know if you agree or disagree.
Sure.
I believe his documentary, The American Revolution, of which you're a part, is really significantly, and is probably the first, if not the only, documentary history that really centers and makes a central part of the history, the period of enslavement.
Yeah.
Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, there have been other documentaries that engage the question of slavery, the experience of African Americans in different ways. But I think this is really the first major one that, you know, really centers the Black experience. And just to be clear, that's what America was in the late 18th century. The idea that Black Americans or slavery somehow peripheral to the 13 colonies, to this era, there's really no way to tell the history of the American Revolution properly without putting, you know, slavery at the center of it. There is no 13 colonies without slavery. So it's in some ways what Ken Burns is doing is really acknowledging the scholarship that's really developed over the last 50 years, you know, to make clear that you know, black history generally, and the history of slavery, even more broadly, is central to understanding the story of the United States and its founding.
So here's a big question. Is enslavement as significant to the American Revolution as it was to the Civil War?
No. And the reason why I say that is because the Civil War was fought over the issue of slavery. The American Revolution was not fought over the institution of slavery. The institution of slavery was implicated in it and had real consequences for how the war was fought, what was said about it, and how it turned out. But the conflict itself was not principally driven by the future of slavery in North America, which is, you know, obviously what drove the conflict in the U.S. Civil War.
But yet its impact was there, because you had, and you talked about this in the documentary, you had Britain and Lord Dunmore saying, hey, so those of you who are enslaved can come fight for us and win your freedom, right?
That's right. I mean, the British government throughout the conflict, you know, saw the enslavement of peoples of African descent as potentially a strategic opportunity, because they recognized that the desire to be free and the willingness to escape slaveholders, which obviously happened long before the American Revolution too, could really undermine the effort of the Continental Army and the individual states trying to attain their independence. And just to be clear, I think I didn't say this at the outset, you know, the British government was not anti-slavery. In Jamaica, in Barbados, in St. Kitts, Antigua, slaveholding was extraordinarily powerful for the British Empire. The British were the principal leading slave traders in the Atlantic world in this period. But they recognized the strategic opportunity of undermining North American independence, you know, by offering liberty selectively to enslaved men and women. So yeah, I mean, it was a, you know, it became a very big part of the war, especially in the Southern colonies.
So Christopher Brown with us, folks, of Columbia University. He is one of the historians featured in Ken Burns' new documentary, The American Revolution. So one of the things you also, in the documentary, help us understand, And I'm reminded, I was, this fall, I spoke on the campus of the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah.
And in doing my research, you know, we talked about how that area, for many years, the majority of its population were enslaved people. And we know that to be the case. But what we find out in American Revolution, that was the case in several of the colonies, especially in Virginia. It was at least 40% in Virginia. So
can
you help us understand just how large of a population we were, even though in bondage?
Yeah. No, so, I mean, you know, the story is that there was about 500,000, you know, people of African descent, both free and enslaved, in the 13 colonies at the time of the, you know, the Declaration of Independence, concentrated, you know, in South Carolina and Virginia. South Carolina had a black majority. Virginia's population was almost 50%, you know, black. You know, Georgia had a rapidly growing slaveholding, you know, it's a rapidly growing black population. But even New York, you know, the colony, then state of New York, 15 to 20% of the population was black. Pennsylvania, a smaller portion. So there were, you know, there were people of African descent, you know, in all 13 of the original colonies. And not only that, Mark, but there was also, slavery was legal in all of these places. You know, we can tend to think about, you know, project backward from later period, the North and the South. The Northern colonies, you know, were slaveholding as well at this period of time. So, you know, it was a central part of America. Right up until the time of independence.
And of course, as you said, the Civil War, enslavement was directly responsible, not so much the American Revolution. Yet, If I understand this correctly, folks, and this is why this history is very important.
Yeah.
There was a lot going on in the Caribbean.
Yes.
There was even around 1776, major slave revolt being planned in Jamaica.
Absolutely. That's right.
Coupled with the fact that the Revolutionary War was affecting Britain's trade in the Caribbean, mm-hmm. which, if I'm not mistaken, also had an effect on those enslaved in Jamaica and the Caribbean, which may have inspired that revolt. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So the British Empire, and what historians like to refer to in this period as the Atlantic world, was an integrated unit. The economies were integrated. And so North America and the British West Indies, Jamaica, Barbados, the West African coast where British slave ships voyaged, and the ports in England itself, such as Bristol and Liverpool, as well as London, all of these were part of one economic unit. And so when there was disruption or troubles in one part of it, it affected all the other parts of it. You know, and so on the 1776 point, you know, the British government, when they decided they had to put down the American rebellion once and for all, and they, you know, they launched, you know, tens of thousands of soldiers sent into, you know, into New York City's harbor, they pulled a lot of ships out of the Caribbean. They pulled soldiers out of Jamaica, where they had a major naval base. And as soon as those soldiers and ships left, the enslaved people in Jamaica were like, hey, this is our opportunity, right? The forces have left. The plantation class is distracted. They don't have the same support from the home government that they normally do because they're fighting a war in North America. This is the moment to plan a conspiracy and an uprising. Now, it got discovered before it was able to, you know, before it was able to take full effect. But there are all kinds of spin-off effects of the war in North America that affect, you know, other parts of the British Empire and other parts of the slaving world. I mean, just one other, you know, bit of this. People don't always realize that the British islands like Jamaica and Barbados and Antigua, they tended to rely on food and supplies from North America because they devoted all of their plantation labor and their land to sugar. Hmm. So a lot of the food, the horses, the lumber, they came in from places like Philadelphia and Baltimore and Boston and New York City and Newport, Rhode Island. And so when war gets waged in North America, all those sources of supplies that help keep the Caribbean islands profitable and that provide the sustenance for enslaved men and women, all of that gets, you know, severely disrupted. So, you know, one of the sort of spin-off effects of the war in North America is to actually create famine conditions in some parts of the British Caribbean, especially in Barbados, where unfortunately a lot of, you know, enslaved Africans end up starving because of the cutoff of trade. So it's, you know, we think about, and it's perfectly understandable, in the United States, we're very focused on the 13 colonies and the beginning of our nation, but you know, North America was part of a much broader whole that, you know, what happened here had ramifications, really severe ramifications in other places.
And wasn't there a fear, historian Christopher Brown with us, folks, wasn't there a fear in this country, in the United States, on the part of the colonists that those enslaved here would be inspired by those enslaved by the Caribbean and later on Haiti, et cetera. And there were, which is another part of history that's kind of written out, we had some revolts here in this country, did we not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the fear of slave uprisings, the fear of insurgency from within dates the history of slavery in North America from the very founding colonies from Virginia in the 17th century and South Carolina in the early 18th century and New York in the early 18th century. It was the aspect, you know, it's ironic. Nobody forces European settlers to enslaved Africans, but it was the aspect of slavery that they worried about most. they didn't worry so much about the morals or the justice or, you know, whether it was Christian. I mean, they came to worry about some of those other things too. But what they really worried about was whether it was sustainable, whether the social costs, whether the cost to, as we would say today, law and order, were justified, were costs that, you know, could bear given the prospect of uprisings. And there were uprisings. I mean, most famously in South Carolina, it's known as the Stono Rebellion in the 1730s, where, hundreds of enslaved people, you know, rise up and kill a significant number of white colonists and start marching to Georgia with the idea that they're going to, you know, join up with Spanish colonists in Florida. That had the effect, people don't always realize this, that had the effect of shutting down imports, slave trading imports into South Carolina for a decade. The South Carolina government said, we're not going to import any more black people because it's just too dangerous. Now, again, they did that for about 10 years and then went right back to it. But the anxieties about slave uprisings were there all the way through. And it really informs patriot decision-making when the Revolutionary War begins in 1775 and 1776.
I want to just jump ahead, and the audience who's listened to me over the years has heard me mention this before and even had this guest on. I just want to ask you, I don't know whether you're familiar with Professor Carl Bogus at Roger Williams University and his research on the hidden history of the Second Amendment, but his thesis is, and there it's documented, Patrick Henry said, we need the Second Amendment because of the potential of these slave insurrections, which kind of explodes this fantasy that, oh, we wanted guns, that the colonists wanted guns or militias needed guns in case there would be another war or another uprising from the British. They actually put words on, no, these black folk that we're amongst are a threat to us. Then what he also brings up, he alludes to something very important that's in the American Revolution, ladies and gentlemen. That's why I hope people can watch it. There were some original lines in the Declaration of Independence, that list of grievances, where and I'm paraphrasing, but the inference would have been that Great Britain put the United States and the colonies at risk because of enslavement, almost as if Great Britain imposed the institution. And now y'all
Correct.
Put us in danger and want us, you know, the very institution you imposed on us might take us out. And right? Am I right about that?
That's absolutely right. It becomes a sort of a favorite talking point among American patriots, and especially in the South, especially in Virginia and South Carolina. You know, this was a favorite point to make Thomas Jefferson or somebody like Henry Lawrence in South Carolina, who was a major importer of captive Africans. You know, they decided that the way to explain their dependence on slavery was to describe it as a conspiracy of the British government and British merchants to force slaves on them, and then therefore leave them vulnerable so that they could not acquire their own political rights. Now, I mean, the absurdity of this is just, is patently obvious. It's even, what's especially absurd about it, if you know a little bit about the history of the British slave trade, in the previous 50, 60 years, British slaveholders in Virginia and South Carolina were complaining constantly that they couldn't get enough slaves delivered. And so the idea that this was a kind of a conspiracy of the British government to force it on them is obviously just not true. But what that points out is the way that in this period, a commitment to slavery starts looking like a kind of political vulnerability, all right? So when Jefferson's talking about slavery in North America is Britain's fault, what that shows is, in part, is they're recognizing that they've got something to explain. They've got a problem to explain in how they're talking about natural rights and liberties and are still slaveholders. The conflicts that, you know, we obviously know about and talk about today, they were talking about that at the time, too. That's not a new discovery. The inconsistency, the hypocrisy. That's something that was was widely debated on both sides of the Atlantic. So the way that American slaveholders sometimes dealt with that is say, you know, we didn't really want these black people here anyway. They were forced on us. And now we have this institution of slavery that we can't wait to abolish as soon as we're independent. None of which, of course, was true, but that was one of the things that they liked to say.
Yeah, yeah. Folks, historian Christopher Brown with us on enslavement in Ken Burns' American Revolution. There's some other topics we're going to cover too, because there were one major revelation that came to me, and I've shared this with people as I've encouraged them to see. And when I say it, they're like, really? The documentary, they couldn't have said that, Mark. So no, they did. In fact, if I reached out to Ken, he's tied up, but I was going to, I mean, the portrayal of enslavement, it's so much in this, and knowing PBS is in trouble, I was like, man, I don't know. This is, you know, if MAGA watches this documentary, and he is
some of them have, and they've decided that, you know, and you can imagine the language and discourse around it. They've decided that it's a biased, inaccurate, you know, fake hoax, all the language, you know, woke. Series. I mean, I'd be happy to talk about, you know, that way of casting it, but I just want to underscore this again. The documentary draws on the strongest, most deeply researched scholarship on the Revolutionary era that's been published basically since the bicentennial, since 1976. Slavery is not the only issue by far. There's a lot of military history. There's a lot of Native American history. There's a lot of social history. For the first time, you know, women, both black and white, get their due. What it reflects is a deeper understanding of the revolution and the revolutionary period, but a deeper understanding that actually reflects the past rather than what might be some wishes about what the past had been.
That's right. That's right. Just as you mentioned, the way women are portrayed, and we saw women in combat in American Revolution. Let's start there. Speak to that, first of all, and how women's roles are more centered, even though, just like enslaved people, the phrase all men are created equal at that time also certainly didn't include women.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I mean, well, we certainly know that there were women who essentially cross-dressed, who dressed as men, and, you know, when they had the opportunity to do so, until they were discovered, in some cases after they were discovered, you know, were bearing arms and fighting. But even more so, you know, it's important. You know, this is a war that's taking place on a home front, you know, in the 13 colonies. And both on the Patriot side and on the Loyalist side, you know, there are women who are doing all of the work in supporting armies on both sides of the conflict, which, you know, there's just so much logistical work, not only, you know, in sort of, you know, traditionally gendered, you know, labor, as, you know, in terms of cooking and cleaning, but, growing crops. You know, when the men are away, the women's responsibilities in terms of caring for lands, you know, doing business, all of those things is much more, you know, much more profound, much more heavily, you know, depended on. So there's a tendency sometimes to think of military history and war history as men's history. And I think one of the things that the American Revolution documentary really makes clear is just how the various roles that women played during the conflict were fundamental to the success of the Continental Army, and also fundamental on the Loyalist side to sustaining the British Army, where, let's just remember, they were fighting a war thousands of miles away from home. So they had to really sustain themselves by drawing upon local resources. And the extent to which they were able to draw upon local resources often had a lot to do with whether, you know, the Loyalist families would support them. So, I mean, this is a whole social mobilization on both sides. It's not just professional armies in the field.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
So you say you could speak to this. Tell us, I've seen some things, but not much. How is MAGA dealing? I don't know. I've even heard Trump address it directly.
Yeah.
Because
and I don't think, you know, and I want to be, you know, I've been involved in the, you know, the production, the development of this project over several years. I was really fortunate to serve as an advisor in addition to kind of a talking head. And so I've had some investment in, you know, what the reaction would be. And so most of my take in this regard is more based on the sorts of things that turn up on, you know, various chat groups or, you know, social media. So I wouldn't say that there's a kind of an official response. Okay. But one thing that I would just, my observation is that the sense that the story of slavery and the choices made by Black men and women, that the importance of Native American history and especially patriot ambitions for Native American land, that the role of women is acknowledged and taken seriously. This is taken as, in some ways, a sign of well, what's often said about it is it's either woke or it's DEI or it's bad, like all these kind of buzz terms that to me are very empty and don't really mean anything. They're just kind of scare words. But they're also meant to try to delegitimize the project. You know, I think that the folks who end up watching it end up being kind of surprised on the, you know, on the more MAGA side to see that that's actually not what the, you know, what the film is about at all. I mean, all of the,
right.
You know, you might say that all of the so-called founding fathers get their due. It's just that their lives, their choices are told in a much more complicated way. And so that those aspects of George Washington's career as a military leader, you know, draw, you know, are presented in ways that I think any audience member would end up coming away with, you know, respect and admiration for him. At the same time, being aware of the fact that he, you know, was not only a slaveholder, but also, you know, really coveted Native American land and was eager to, you know, displace it. So, you know, we're dealing with human beings, not statues, not, you know, demigods. We're dealing with people who had virtues and vices like you do, like I do. And understanding the revolutionary period means looking at these folks and really seeing them for the rounded, complex people that they were. And it's a shame in some ways that in some political quarters, it feels necessary to pretend as if people were not people, but instead were, you know, gods of some kinds. And I just don't understand how that helps us understand the past. I really don't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, well, I mean, as a historian, you know, the way history is rewritten and people are mythologized in that way. Because you mentioned General Washington, but also, I mean, we actually see him as human.
Yeah.
And there were military mistakes.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's one of the great things. You know, the sort of the lead military historian in this thing, Rick Atkinson, you know, at one point says he was not a great strategist. You know, I mean, almost lost the war at the outset in Brooklyn because he fails to defend one flank. And the Continental Army is almost crushed, you know, in the very first months of the war after the Declaration of Independence. You know, he makes all kinds of strategic mistakes. And I think what ends up being impressive about Washington is that he ends up prevailing, even though he's not always a great, you know, strategist and military commander. So, you know, that's the kind of insight that I think the team really wanted to try to convey is that you've got people who are impressive in one ways and then deeply unimpressive in other ways. And that's any person that we admire in history, I think, you know, that is in fact the true story of their life if we're really willing to look at them clearly and honestly and deeply.
Dr. Christopher Brown with us of Columbia University, who features prominently in Ken Burns' American Revolution. So this is what I wanted to say. This is my revelation.
Yeah.
And when I've said this to people like, Mark, you exaggerate. They didn't do that. I said, yes, they did. So this is it. And it has to do with indigenous people, with Native America. Y'all, we've all been taught in school from birth, Tea Party, tax on tea. You know, and you hear about the other taxes, but the Tea Party was it. That was the thing. What I got, and maybe I'm slow, but what I got that really, really stood out was the other main issue, and I think you alluded to it, Dr. Brown. Britain said, you know what? You all don't go any further west, you colonists. Y'all stay right where you are,
yep.
And we're going to put a moratorium on you expanding into indigenous territory.
Yep.
It's almost as if that was the last straw. So in other words, colonists don't want to be a part of an empire.
Yeah.
But they want to build their own empire going west. And to, I mean, you know that, but when it is couched in that way, the way the documentary does it, that says, oh, that's a paradox, isn't it?
And they're not disguising their ambitions at all. You know, they're not disguising, you know, they foresaw and they wanted what in fact ended up happening, which is stretching the American empire, you know, from the Eastern Seaboard all the way to the Pacific Ocean. You know, this was hiding in plain sight. They called it the Continental Congress and the Continental Army for a reason.
Hello.
Right? I mean, you know, at the time that they were doing this, right, they resided in cities that hugged the East Coast.
Yeah.
You know, I-95.
Yeah.
Charleston to, right. You know, to Richmond, to Baltimore, to Philadelphia, to New York, to Boston. You know, that was the heart of, you know, the 13 colonies. And they were just starting to expand west into, you know, territory that, you know, think of Western Virginia and Central Pennsylvania and upstate New York. But the land hunger, the idea that, especially once the French had been driven out of what's present-day Canada in a lot of the Midwest, because the French had claims in those parts of North America up until the 1760s, American colonists were like, that's going to be our land. And the British government took the view that if they start spreading westward, we're never going to be able to control them. Never mind the fact they're going to get into all kinds of conflicts with all the different Indian nations, you know, on the other side of the Appalachians. And then we're going to have to send the army in to defend them. They're going to start wars, and then we're going to have to send in the military to protect them. So the idea was that we can govern these 13 colonies better if they stay close to the Atlantic Ocean. We can tax them better. We can govern them better. We can, you know, we can defend them better in time of war. But if they go out there, we're never going to be able to control them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, no one's ever gotten very far by telling Americans what to do. So, you know, part of what happens is that, you know, in all of the states, but especially Connecticut, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, North Carolina, they're all looking at native land as the place in which to expand. And so that is one of the major grievances, is what's this, that's called the proclamation line, where the British government says, you will not settle west of the Appalachians. And, you know, that is a major, major grievance. And it's one of the ways, one of the benefits of independence. You know, and so just to, you know, to conclude the point, Mark, I mean, one of the benefits that's extended to soldiers in the Continental Army is that if you serve a certain number of years, at the end of the war, you will receive Native American land.
Hey.
They're going to be paid. Soldiers are going to be paid in land that America does not yet own or possess. Right? So that's you're not the only one who this will be new to. I mean, this is an aspect of the history of the revolution, which was not well understood you know, as recently as, you know, 3 decades ago. The bicentennial, there was no discussion of the, you know, the way that American land hunger and conflicts with Native Americans figured. There was discussion of slavery a little bit in 1976. I remember it. I was a kid, but I was, you know, we were starting to talk about Crispus Attucks and, you know, Backpage. But there was no discussion of Native Americans. So I think a lot of folks are going to be very surprised by that aspect of it and discover just how important it is for understanding the revolutionary period.
Dr. Brown, you mentioned what the colonists, and that's another interesting aspect, that they were offering to pay people in land they didn't even have yet. There's that. But back to the British, they were promising emancipation for those of us who are enslaved.
That's right.
Do we have an idea just how broadly African Americans participated as loyalists with the British versus the numbers on the colonist side?
We really don't. I mean, there have been, the best that historians can do on that subject in terms of how many Black people, you know, escaped to British lines or served as, you know, in loyalist corps in one way or another. Excuse me, the best we can do is to say it's numbered in the tens of thousands. So it was significant.
Yeah.
But there's no way, the kinds of records that would allow us to get a real headcount just does not exist. But, you know, the real point is that it was substantial. And there were far more who served on the British side than served on the North American side. That seems pretty clear. And, you know, it was a major political opportunity and a major rupture in slavery in North America and to a degree in white supremacy, in the British government essentially saying, you know, come serve the crown, and you will be recognized as a subject of the crown, and you will be free to, you know, live your, you know, to within your means to do, you know, live life as you choose at the end of the war. That really had not happened before in the British Empire. I mean, you know, some historians have sometimes described it as the largest slave revolt in North American history. It was also, to a degree, the largest collective manumission. You might almost say a kind of emancipation as well. And again, I don't want to get anybody get the impression that the British government was abolitionist or anti-slavery. This was strategic. But the fact of the matter is that the British war effort had the effect of making it possible for tens of thousands of Black people to free themselves over the course of the war. And it really has a dramatic impact on individual lives and also, you know, political vision. I mean, many Black people come out of the revolutionary period absolutely committed to the British crown, committed to the loyalist cause, seeing themselves as British subjects, because it was the British government, you know, that, you know, allowed them to become free, even if their ancestors had come over on British slave ships the generation before, right? So there are all kinds of ironies and paradoxes in this history. But yeah, the history of Black loyalists is something that not a lot of Americans know about, but it is it's one of the real consequences of this time period.
And for those who were, quote unquote, freed and left the country with other loyalists and went to, I think some went to Nova Scotia, others went elsewhere.
Correct.
But then weren't they subject to other harms, including illness and disease?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, so I don't want to make this sound like too much of a triumphant story, because right, in some ways there's this kind of moment of opportunity, and then there's just horrific tragedy as well. I mean, much of the folks who, you know, escaped with the Virginia governor, the Earl of Dunmore, you know, and join his effort to put down the Patriot Rebellion in Virginia, most of those folks end up dying of smallpox, which in the 18th century just could wreak havoc on populations anywhere, but especially, you know, in a seaborne fleet that was having a hard time, you know, finding a safe place to land. I mean, this happened also at the end of the war in Virginia. A lot of the Black folks who escaped to join Charles Cornwallis in his march through Virginia A lot of those folks, you know, died of smallpox. There's some untold number of people who escaped to British lines who most of us believe were then resold into slavery, though the promise of freedom was not actually preserved. And, you know, an unknown number were probably sold into the British Caribbean colonies. But some did, you know, acquire their freedom and then, you know, left with the British, went to Canada, some went to England, but then found themselves in situations where, you know, they were not in a situation where they could support themselves, where they were given the worst land or had the least opportunities. And some of those folks ended up migrating, you know, under British patronage, kind of, to Sierra Leone. So, you know, it's a really, the story of the Black diaspora out of the United States in the Revolutionary period is one of the, you know, is a really key aspect for Black history of the Revolutionary period. It's not just like those who remain in North America, but a lot of Black people born in North America end up ending their, you know, living the remainders of their lives in Canada or in England or Sierra Leone, or perhaps re-enslaved in the Caribbean or the Bahamas. So, you know, there's a whole migration, somewhat voluntary, somewhat forced, out of America at the end of the Revolutionary War.
While Thomas Jefferson is composing the Declaration of Independence, someone who's staying up with him all night and bringing him coffee, he is an enslaved person. See, there was moments of the document y'all are just pointing. You just kind of have to stop and say, wait a minute, I need to rewind that. We can do that with Civil War when that came out. Yep. But our TVs can rewind now. Yep. I mean, did I hear that? And if I'm not mistaken, that enslaved person is related to him, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
This could be a reality show, y'all. So, yeah. Okay.
No, it's the half-sister of his wife, who becomes the mother of Sally Hemings, who obviously, you know, has a long sexual relationship with Jefferson, who bears a number of his children. I don't think any of us should be brave or courageous enough to say exactly what was going on in that relationship. It was a sexual relationship, and it's not clear how much of a choice she had over it. But yeah, I mean, you know, our history is a mixed history. It's a interracial history. It is a history in which all of the, in which white supremacy is a fundamental part of it. And yet at the same time, all the complexities of social relations where people are living cheek by jowl and know each other intimately. You know, there's all those dimensions of it as well. There's a man, a boy named William Lee, who serves George Washington over the course of the war. He's enslaved to George Washington. There are innumerable opportunities during the war where he almost certainly could have run away from George Washington. At the end of the war, at the end of Washington's life, Washington, you know, leaves him with a pension of a kind. You know, it's just, if you think about, again, all of the different ways that people relate to each other in our own world, where there are hierarchies and where there are power and differences, and all the complex emotions, resentments that develop with that. I mean, slavery is another level, obviously, but, you know, it's again, I've said this before, but we're dealing with human beings. And we're dealing with human beings that have all the complexities and contradictions and who don't always behave the way that we would want them to, you know, including the people that, you know, that you and I are descended from. Yeah. So, you know, that's what it means to really take to look at this past in a serious way.
And speaking of George Washington, there was one of his enslaved people, one of the people he enslaved, who did run away and join the Loyalists, correct?
Yep.
And was he recaptured? Do I have that right?
Yeah, Harry Washington was, so here's a guy who is, he was born in the Gambia River Valley, taken and, you know, captured, sold into the Atlantic slave trade when he was a child or an adolescent. you know, comes to Washington and sold into Washington's estate. Washington puts them to work at hard labor in the dismal swamp, you know, in the boundary between Virginia and North Carolina, some of the most, you know, difficult work that one can do in the Chesapeake at this period of time. He runs away constantly, you know, and Washington is he's like one of these folks who will just not submit. And when, you know, Dunmore offers the opportunity to run away, you know, Harry Washington is one of those people who escapes. You know, he survives. He ends up going to New York and serving, you know, the loyalist, you know, the loyalist cause. Yeah. And he's one of these folks who ends up going in Nova Scotia and Sierra Leone. So, you know, there are stories like that all the way through the history.
Lastly, Dr. Brown, before we let you go, and we so appreciate this, folks, it's always a treasure to have people who spend this time with us. We can just watch him on a documentary, but I'm glad he's done this. And this definitely won't be the last time we speak. What's next for you? What are you working on any projects right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for asking. So I'm working on a variety of different projects. You know, I mean, I teach, you know, my teaching at Columbia, I do a lecture class on the Atlantic slave trade every year, which is, you know, really important for, you know, the undergraduate teaching that I do. I'm really interested in trying to understand how the Atlantic slave trade worked. Mm. And when I say how it worked, I mean how it worked at that point on the West African coast, where you had, you know, elite black men selling captured black people to elite European men. Mm. And I'm really trying to understand in that moment where you've got elites on both sides doing business with poor people who have lost their freedom and who are impoverished. That's one of the things that I'm really trying to, you know, I'm really trying to make sense of. I'm doing a lot around the, you know, the 250th and the American Revolution. And, you know, I'm pushing out some of this knowledge about, you know, telling the history, you know, of this period in a more complicated way that reflects the fact that, you know, ours is a history which, you know, is deeply rooted in the history of slavery, in the history of race, in the history of racial conflict, and also the history of hope in the sense that, you know, in the history of possibilities. So
the new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
And just so you know, full disclosure, I've been a part of the reparations movement most of my life. Before, by the way, this MAGA influenced generation of those who are against Pan-Africanism and talk about foundational Black Americans. The fact of the matter is, as the documentary shows, and if you pointed out, a lot of us came through the Caribbean.
So
it's a worldwide, there's no such thing as just, you know, we just popped up under Cabbage Patch here, y'all.
No.
As African Americans. So my brother, what you shared and the research you're doing is important. And I think you also made the case to serve as an expert witness in days to come when it comes to talking about reparations. But we
happy
thank
you so.
Yes, sir. We're thankful for you. And we want people to watch Ken Burns' American Revolution, folks. And Dr. Christopher Brown has been our very special guest. Dr. Brown, such a pleasure to meet you. And we'll definitely be back in touch, man. Okay.
I really, really enjoyed it. Really appreciate it. Thank you for the invitation, the opportunity. Be good, everybody.
Thanks for getting woke and listening to Make It Plain. As always, perform an act of kindness on behalf of an elder or young person. Write a letter to a sister or brother who just so happens to find her or himself incarcerated. Offer libations to the ancestors upon whose sturdy shoulders we all now stand. And above all, give thanks to the God of your understanding by whatever name you call her and him. All God asks of us is that we give each other love. Thanks for giving MIP love. And please remember to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. If all hearts and minds are clear, it has been made plain.